Porto, good morning to you. You may approach, but hold on just a second. We've got folks coming in and out of the courtroom. And just for everybody's planning purposes, I didn't mention this at the beginning of oral arguments, but it is currently the court's intention that after the fifth argument of the day, which is State versus Dodick, we intend to take a short 10 or 15 minute recess and then come back and take the last two cases of the day after that recess. Ms. Klein, you are also here today.
Yes,
do either counsel have any questions before you begin?
I do not.
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Porto, you may proceed.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Mark Porto. I'm here today on behalf of my client, Mr. Lincho Ali. This case involves a conviction that missed a first-degree sexual assault that occurred on May 31st, 2013 for an incident that happened on May 17th of 2012. This, however, is actually Mr. Ali's direct appeal. In all candor, Mr. Ali absconded for a period of time, and his conviction was just rendered final in 2021. The central focus of this appeal is the district court's determination that a prior allegation of sexual assault that was made by the complaining witness against a third party, the district court's decision that prior recanted false allegation was inadmissible at Mr. Ali's trial by Mr. Ali.
Mr. Porto, I'd like to focus on that a little bit. The evidence consists of the interview of the complaining witness with law enforcement about the event that occurred with the doctor. And then there's also a deposition which was taken for this particular case where the complaining witness was asked questions about that event.
Right.
I am not finding anywhere in there that the complaining witness used the term sexual assault. And I confess it's a little hard to understand what she says because of the way that she speaks. But I hear intentional touching, and I hear I almost slapped him, but I never heard the word sexual assault. Is it in there somewhere, do you think?
I agree with you. I'm not sure that those specific words were said explicitly.
So could it possibly be that what we're talking about is not a sexual assault report, but a simple assault report?
Well, I think it's fair, a very fair inference that what she was complaining about to law enforcement during the course of her interview was sexual impropriety on behalf of the doctor.
You think that inference is stronger than an inference that it was simply a touching that was not consented to?
Well, I think given the nature of the examination that she indicated she was there for, a prenatal examination, I believe she said he was touching her leg inappropriately, which under the definition of sexual contact would be included.
Doesn't that matter where on the leg it was?
Anything above, I believe the statute and the case law interpreting that statute indicates anything above the kneecap, I think, is the correct interpretation of that. In any event though, I think it was very clear what she was complaining had happened. The fact that she said she almost slapped him, the fact that she said that she called the doctor's office and indicated that she was going to make a report to law enforcement if the doctor's office did not do something to rectify the situation, a threat that she did make good on. I think the clear implication, even if she didn't use the exact words of sexual assault or sexual contact, was that's exactly what she was complaining about, and I don't think that's a stretch by any means. And turning to the facts of this case, that allegation, I think, really was critical. Because at the heart of this case was basically a fact-finding mission by the jury of credibility regarding both J.K., the complaining witness, and Mr. Ali, who the jury saw an interview with conducted by law enforcement of Mr. Ali. They had very similar stories. They met at a library. They walked to a hotel room. They waited while Mr. Ali rented a hotel room. They went up voluntarily both together to the hotel room. They're in agreement insofar as that. Their stories diverged when it came to what exactly happened in that hotel room. Mr. Ali said that J.K. made sexual advances towards him. J.K. had basically the polar opposite recollection, and it indicated that she had done things to indicate resistance. And so the question really came down to a credibility determination. And also,
how would the information you were seeking to be admitted, the earlier report about the doctor, how would that help a jury with credibility?
Well, because it was an allegation that was made by J.K. Regarding sexual impropriety on behalf of the doctor. Later, a completely different recollection by J.K. and a completely different characterization of what happened. And 2 years prior, when she made the report to law enforcement, she said she almost slapped the doctor. She said, I called his office and I was appalled by, I'm summarizing, but I was appalled by his behavior. In the deposition testimony, she said, it was normal procedure for a prenatal examination. I think that clearly would impact, those differing accounts of what happened would clearly impact the jury's interpretation of the credibility of J.K. And
she never did change her view that she was touched by the doctor.
Right, but
So in that sense, isn't that a distinguishing factor from some of the cases that you're relying on?
I don't believe so at all. Because if you look at the definition, one of the other arguments that we made at this trial was the definition of without consent requires in the statute that the lack of consent, this is 28.318 subsection 8b, that the lack of consent be conveyed and be genuine and real and conveyed to the defendant in a manner so as to reasonably make known to that person that there is no consent. And the fact, I think in both situations, with the prenatal doctor and with Mr. Ali, there's no question that there was touching. The question was whether that was consensual in the doctor, with the incident with the doctor, whether that's consensual be as part of a doctor examination. With Mr. Ali, whether it was consensual as part of a sexual encounter. And the fact that J.K. had a difficulty recalling the context or being consistent with the relation to the context of the touching that happened with the doctor is directly relevant to her ability to recall and to appropriately characterize and contextualize the encounter with Mr. Ali, and in particular, whether any resistance that she gave was reasonably made known to Mr. Ali. And that's particularly important in this case because by all accounts, the most definitive, clear expression of a lack of consent happened when she screamed. And at that point, J.K. indicates Mr. Ali stopped and let her, and she left. He didn't make any attempt to stop her from leaving. And so it really is critical what happened up to that point, before that point. How clear was the resistance to Mr. Ali?
Do you think the importance of this is a recantation by her or her, the way she expresses lack of consent?
Yeah, I think...
What's the important factor of this prior evidence?
I think just in both incidents, it involves context and the appropriate characterization of the touching, right? Whether it was for sexual gratification or not with relation to the doctor, and whether there was consent involving Mr. Ali. Both of those scenarios involve really important details about exactly what happened in the context of that encounter. And the fact that J.K. went from, I was a victim of a sexual assault by this doctor, which I believe is a fair characterization of her interview with law enforcement, to 2 years later, it was just normal procedure for a pregnancy, clearly calls into question her credibility and her ability to accurately contextualize and put into appropriate characterization what happened in that hotel room before she screamed.
Does it call into question her truthfulness?
So I'm not sure that it calls into question her truthfulness. I'm not saying she was a liar. We never said that. But I think it does call into question her ability to accurately recall clearly to the jury and whether in the credibility to give to that because of her demonstrated inability to recall details, but really important details in a case like this.
Thank you.
I see that I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. This is a weird case start to finish, and part of the weirdness is that the defendant is relying on Swindle, a case which was decided years after he was convicted and years before he was sentenced. We'll just assume for the sake of argument that Swindle does apply to this, and he is obliged then to show, before he cross-examines her, and incidentally that's not what he ultimately said he wanted to do, he wanted to call her as his own witness in his case in chief. That's not cross-examination, and that seems to be what Swindle has limited itself to, is cross-examination of the witness, so don't know if the Swindle even applies as a result of that, but let's assume that it would be cross-examination, because that's initially where we started.
What do you think the rule or constitutional underpinnings of Swindle are?
Swindle as I read Swindle, it looked to be a confrontation issue. I'm not sure that necessarily, but even that being the case, even Swindle ultimately concluded that there wasn't a constitutional problem because the evidence that was excluded there was limited to prior sexual contact, which is not really what we have here, with someone other than the defendant, which is a collateral issue, and it had no bearing on whether or not the defendant assaulted the victim, sexually assaulted the victim in that case.
So collateral issue sounds like Rule 608?
Yeah, I agree. And Swindle says the defendant has to basically show three things by the greater weight of the evidence that the accusation was in fact made. I don't think there's any real question about that in this case. That the accusation was false and that the evidence was more probative than prejudicial. I think both of those two are where we start running into problems. And part of how this is going to be decided is how we decide to parse out our terms. That the accusation was false depends on what you mean by that. The facts are the same. She would testify that the facts of what she initially said and what she continues to maintain happened are the same. It's what's changed is her evaluation of them, her interpretation of them. And in her deposition, she explained why she made the initial accusation. Basically, she was browbeaten into it by her roommate who insisted on being present at the evaluation, who then told the other roommate, who then essentially obliged her to call law enforcement. She said she was confused by the whole thing. She didn't really understand what was going on, but because these other two individuals were insisting that she report it to law enforcement, she did. The facts of what happened are the same, so it's not a distinction about what factually happened, it's her interpretation of what happened. And as you can see when she's in the interview with the officer back when the allegations were initially made, it's pretty clear that the officer is kind of going, okay, I see what's going on here. He's very nice to her, he's very polite, but it's pretty clear to him that there was no sexual assault and nothing essentially ever became of that thing. And as she later reflected on it, she said, yeah, I think I was wrong about what actually happened, but this is why I did what I did.
Is that a question of truthfulness?
It's not a question of truthfulness because she was truthful about the facts of what happened, and it was truthful about why she did what she did.
Is it a question in front of us not whether or not something should be excluded, but if admitted, what weight to give it?
Well, I think it would only go for impeachment. So, I mean, that's essentially up to a jury if it's going to be admitted, what weight they're going to give it. And I think under these circumstances, given her, clearly she is a person with special needs, and clearly all you have to do is watch her interview to come to that conclusion, and her mother testified to the same. And I think it's unreasonable, and I think everyone would understand that it's unreasonable for a special needs individual to essentially perceive and react, I guess is how I'd want to put it, the same way that a person would normally respond under these circumstances.
I guess my question was going to the possibility that it might not be entitled to great weight, but that doesn't translate into the evidentiary ruling with respect to admission.
That's true. And
doesn't Rule 608 commit the decision about whether or not to admit this kind of evidence to the trial court's discretion?
Yes, it absolutely
so
does.
So that just brings us back to, was the exclusion an abuse of discretion?
Yeah, it was not an abuse of discretion. I think under the facts of this thing, and the judge, everybody kind of went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth about this, and ultimately it decided that what we were looking at here was a change of perception rather than a change of facts. It was not a false accusation under the very singular circumstances that we have presented before us. It was a change of how she perceived what had happened. And that doesn't necessarily, in the judge's opinion, make it a false accusation. And therefore, it determined that it would not be admissible as impeachment against her. It was just the oddity of how this whole thing shook out. And I think it was it was not a recantation either. And the district court agreed that it was not a recantation. Blacks basically says a recantation is to take back or withdraw a statement that had been made to repudiate that it has not happened. And she never said it didn't happen. She just said, I was wrong about what I thought it was. These are the facts of what happened, but I misperceived what was going on. I don't think that's necessarily should be used to impeach someone, particularly under these particular circumstances. And whether it would be more prejudicial than probative, I don't think it would be essentially probative at all, because given her apparent limitations, her confusion and misinterpretation of the medical examination was reasonably explained. But the same can't be said for the assault on her by Ali. She explained, I was trying to be nice, I was trying to be polite, I was kind of gently pushing him away, trying to tell him no, and then as things progressed, she got a little more aggressive about it. She said, I pushed him away several times, I repeatedly said no, I kicked at him several times. I don't know how that can be interpreted as anything other than a declination to engage in sexual conduct.
Well, if the evidence of the prior interaction with the doctor were admitted, how would that be prejudicial to the state?
I think it would be prejudicial in the sense that it's basically irrelevant, again, because of the particular facts of this. Can it be explained away? Yes. We could have her explain, this is what happened, this is why it happened. And I think it could be basically explained away, but I think the fact that it has to be essentially explained away, and it can be, really renders its usefulness at best tangential to everybody involved in this thing.
Didn't the trial judge express a concern about confusion of the issues? And isn't that an element or a part of a prejudicial analysis?
Yes, it said, I think it will, there's enough confusion in this, we don't need to inject any more into this case by putting that in place. And it said, I find that the risk of confusion is going to be too great, and I'm going to exclude this particular evidence. And I think that's not an abuse of discretion, especially under these particular circumstances.
Before your time expires, In brief, you took the position that Swindle should not apply. Today, you assumed that it applied, but I want to explore your argument, and my question to you about that is, assume that Swindle had occurred immediately after sentencing and before direct appeal, wouldn't we be in exactly the same position that we are now?
Yes, we would. And I think the fact, it's the lapse of time and the reason that, you know, if he had progressed as it should have and he didn't scarper off to Australia for 8 years, then Swindle wouldn't be an issue. But because he deliberately left the country to avoid sentencing, it just seems basically manifestly unfair that he should be able to take advantage of that. I understand that that's probably, that may well not be the case, but it just seems grossly unfair. And I see my time is almost up, so unless there are other questions, we would ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 13 seconds.
18 seconds. We'll give you 30 seconds, Mr.
Okay.
Porto.
Thank you. I'll keep it very brief. Okay. First of all, with the allegation from the state that the recantation was the result of browbeating, or the original report about the doctor was browbeating by her friends, simply watch the video. I don't agree with that, and I don't believe that's a fair characterization of what's depicted on the video. Second, the allegation from the state that the facts were never changed in the mind of JK, it was just her contextual characterization of it. If I'm a juror, I think the question is she going to say the same thing? Is she going to change her characterization about what happened here 2 years later? Thank you.
Before you sit down,
yeah.
Why did the appellant choose to recall the witness instead of pursuing this line of questioning across the
country? So if you indulge me, I don't know that it's very clear in the record. First of all, I don't think it matters. Due process allows the defendant to make strategical decisions about when they call what witnesses. A defendant can call a witness solely for the purpose of impeachment. That's allowed under the rules regarding the fact that a litigant may impeach their own witness. But there were some, I think if I recall, some issues regarding timing of witnesses, and it was late in the day and the judge wanted to reserve ruling on this, I think is what the fact, what happened.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in State versus Ali. Counsel, you are excused, and the court will proceed to State versus Warren.